Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome Eric Wallerstein of Yardeni Research. Eric, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
So I want to tell people that in my classroom at USC, I've been using Yardeni chart packs for several years. High signal information for anybody interested in fixed income and interest rates. So this is an exciting episode for me. Eric, why don't you tell people where you were before you got to Yardeni? Because I know you traded repo at the Fed. You have a very interesting background.
Yeah, so I joined Ed Yardeni here as the chief market strategist back in May. And before that, I was at the Wall Street Journal covering mostly bonds, asset allocation, fiscal and monetary policy, broadly just the U.S. economy. And when I left school, I was on the New York Fed's trading desk. So money markets, repo, you know, Fed funds, $0, and then a lot of the Fed facilities. I was there in 2019 and 2020. The repo market blowout was a really big event until COVID, of course, made it a much smaller event relative, you know, to the broader landscape. So it was definitely a very interesting time to be there. But yeah, it's come full circle and I'm back covering markets now doing sell side research.
Well, we'll have to probably do an entirely separate episode on September 2019 repo crisis and a postmortem. I would love to go through that with you. But give us your take on rates high level before we get into your excellent chart pack here. Rates have gone up quite a bit since they hit 3.6% in the 10-year. Mm-hmm. They've gone up both after the September rate cut and then a little bit more after the election. So give us your take on where 10 stand today, where we've been and where we might be heading.
Yeah, so I think the bond rally that resulted in the 10-year getting down to 3.6 or 3.65% was predicated on a couple of things. I mean, we had that pocket of economic softness, right? We had some weak data. We had that Hurricane Beryl impacted July payrolls report. Plenty of people were going on CNBC calling for emergency rate cuts or supersized cuts. So it was an interesting time. We had a lot of yen volatility dragging on the market. A lot of people who have been calling for a recession wrongly for 2 years thought like, hey, wow, finally I'm right. Like the tighter monetary policy has weighed on the economy. We basically said, you know, it might be time to short bonds in August, right around when they were at 3.8, because I don't think it really matched up with the economic fundamentals. Growth has been really strong. Inflation's been coming down. We're getting disinflation, but I think long-term inflation is probably higher today than it was a couple of years ago, or at least pre-pandemic. So we have stronger nominal growth. There were some weak economic indicators, but that was really a soft patch. The labor market is very strong. And I think people relying on, you know, decelerations from really record tightness and record heat are kind of wrong. But the bond market, you know, took it. It makes sense. The bond market has repriced several times. So what we've seen since the Fed's cut, and we got even more bearish on bonds when the Fed cut by 50 basis points in September, is economic data has been much stronger. If you look at the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index, the 10-year yields rise kind of matches it, right? We've gotten much stronger economic data and, you know, TIPS yields or real yields have risen in accordance. So we're seeing real, you know, real growth expectations come through in the bond market, but we're also seeing higher inflation expectations. It's kind of interesting because you have some weakness in global commodities. China's economy is very weak, or domestic demand is quite weak there. So you're seeing weakness in commodities, but inflation expectations are still rising. And I think that's a result of the bond market saying the Fed is cutting too soon by too much. And the fiscal deficit is already a problem. And it's probably not one that's going away in any shape, way or form. So if we have, you know, more treasury supply coming, stronger growth, higher inflation expectations, it just makes sense that bond yields would rise. So we're sitting at 4.3% on the 10-year right now. I think that makes sense. You know, I think 4.25% makes sense. I think 4.5%. I think you get some supply issues, you can get to 4.75 or 5%. But like, what is the 10-year yield? It's growth and inflation expectations, and then like the residual that is the term premium, which is kind of a concept that's discussed too often for how much signal you can actually derive from it. But if we get 2-2.5% real growth, we get like 2-2.5% inflation expectations. I think that makes sense. So I think the 10-year makes sense here. We were bearish on the way up. I don't really think we're that bearish anymore. You could definitely see rises and I think more volatility. I think bond volatility will be higher, rates vol will be higher. But again, it should be fairly range bound between 4-5%. So I think that's where we're at. You know, bonds are great for income now, but I'm not sure they'll serve as a great hedge for generally risk on assets going forward.
With today's macro landscape, many people are worried that they are not saving enough for retirement. Now you can grow your retirement savings with a tax-advantaged Bitcoin IRA using Unchained. The Unchained IRA is the only solution that allows you to hold your own private keys in an IRA vehicle. Right now, Unchained is running an amazing deal for you guys where you can get started with their IRA for no setup fees and no fees for the first year. You can roll over traditional IRAs or other 401k accounts into this new Unchained IRA, and they can help you set up everything. Go to unchained.com/TBL and experience true ownership over your retirement. Don't risk your Bitcoin security. Do you have Bitcoin private keys stored on paper? Make sure you convert those keys to titanium with Stampseed. Stampseed has this really cool DIY kit that allows you to hammer in your seed phrase into these small titanium plates that are fire resistant and damage resistant. This kit is designed by titanium metal workers that have been working in stamping metal for over 14 years, and your words are deeply stamped, not just a shallow dot. So make sure you check out stampseed.com today and use code TBL for 15% off of your order. Eric, I think that I was guilty of being one of those people overly focused on lagged effects of monetary policy triggering a recession, waiting for it, waiting for it, waiting for it. Then at some point toward the beginning of this year, I understood that even though I'm expecting some lagged effects from monetary policy, if the data's not showing it, it's just not coming. I was one of those people that during that July, August, not calling for an emergency rate cut, but saying, hey, the hard landing is arriving, it's here.
Yeah.
What did we miss? What prevented those lagged effects, or could they still be coming next year? What are people missing about this recession call that they just haven't been able to let go of?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to like what is a long and variable lag. You know what I mean? It's a term that's thrown around a lot, but what does that actually mean? I mean, by and large, I don't think a 5-5.5% Fed funds rate is all that high. You know, it's historically normal when you take out the post great financial crisis kind of ZERP era. It's not too high, and it's, you know, we're seeing strong real growth. So what would cause the recession, right? Pretty much all monetary policy induced recessions in the past were caused by a credit crisis. Something broke, and then there was a credit crunch in the banking system, and then that spiraled into a recession. So we did have a credit crisis this time, and I think the inverted yield curve correctly predicted that short-term rates got jacked up too high, there would eventually be a recession, the Fed would cut. The crisis this time was in the banking system. We saw it with SVB, Signature Bank, it was very closely tied to monetary policy, right? It was literally duration risk that was overdone on both the asset and liability side, and Fed hikes, you know, caused runs on these banks. The difference is the Fed and the Treasury stepped in immediately and stopped the bleeding. There was the Bank Term Funding Program, which was $100, $150 billion of duration risk taken out of the market. But I think implicitly, it was much more. It was the Fed saying, don't worry about any duration risk on your balance sheets. Any bonds that are underwater, we got them. So that was huge for the market. And the FDIC and Treasury basically backstopped all the depositors, which were also very sensitive cohorts of the market, right? You had the entire like venture capital, Silicon Valley, really tech exposed part of the market, and they just backed them very quickly. So that credit crisis happened, but it was stemmed very quickly. We saw all the things that should happen with like the credit crisis, credit crunch associated recession type market moves happen when that was happening, right? Like it really felt like this is it. I was at the Journal covering all the banks when this happened. But the kind of new and novel Fed facility stemmed the bleeding. And then therefore we kind of were able to keep going because there's not like a 5% Fed funds rate doesn't really do much. And if the curve is inverted, I think a few months ago, Uber was newly, their credit rating was newly upped into investment grade, like just barely. And they raised long-term debt like at 5.25%, like literally at the Fed funds rate, right? You have a very inverted curve. Financing conditions are quite easy. So there's no like, there's not a lot of pressure overall in the market. You know, there's people who took out high rated floating rate debt during the pandemic and they're under pressure, but that's kind of your fault, right? It's a business model issue. So I think the big variable that people missed is you need a crisis to induce those quote unquote long and variable lags and for lending to dry up and credit to dry up. We had one, it basically got stopped by easy monetary policy and easy fiscal policy. They pumped those sectors so that, you know, everything would be okay. So we kind of carried along. If you look at the senior loan officer survey, the SLOOS from the Fed, the banks aren't even tightening credit conditions for large firms anymore. Like, why are we cutting rates when banks are saying we're, you know, financing conditions are getting easier? IG and high yield spreads are both incredibly tight due to a variety of factors, but just there doesn't really look like to be any recession risk. Financing conditions aren't difficult for corporations. I think where financing conditions are really tough are for households and for mortgages and buying a home. But why are homes so expensive when mortgage rates went up? In part because the Fed bought like $3 trillion in MBS and kind of created this situation. So I think that's what a lot of people missed. And I also think the US had a very unique influx of immigration during the past couple years, which made up for like a huge wave of early retirements by boomers. So it was a very unique situation. COVID and the pandemic are like not normal recessions, right? And not normal monetary policy. But when you tighten policy after like trillions of dollars of stimulus and everyone terms out their debt and the economy is running really strong, it's just different than tightening monetary policy from like a normal economy. But I think it was natural to expect a recession. I just think like we're coming up on like 3 years now, you know, since people have been calling for it. It's probably time to move on. You know what I mean? But yeah.
Yeah, it's a great answer. And one of the things that we flagged in the middle of the year was the unbelievable strength in the corporate bond market. I get a note from one of the IB shops every morning with the issuance numbers. And week mm-hmm. after week, the volume, the issuance, it and the net numbers are all positive. It just means that there's just new demand for, there's just credit, there's strength in the credit market that yeah. is undeniable and doesn't match with any recession sort of vibe. Have you noticed anything there in the IG market? Is that something you watch?
Yeah, I mean, what's the investment grade spread at, right? Like 100 bips maybe? So the curve's inverted. I mean, you can issue debt at 5%. That's pretty good, all things considered. I just think, I mean, the cost of equity is, you know, stocks are at all-time highs. Seemingly every day there's a new record. But I think you'd probably see wider spreads, all else equal. I mean, private credit has, I think, disrupted or hampered the effectiveness or transmission of monetary policy. You had a lot of lenders with liabilities that aren't like sensitive to short-term fluctuations. There's no run on a private credit firm. They lock up that funding and they can make riskier loans. You know what I mean? They have less regulations. This isn't like a socialized sector, you know, where the government has bailed out before. So when you kind of take away those really risky lenders from the high yield market, or at least you add competition for lending, like you should get spread compression. There's a lot of money chasing fewer loans. So it's just a fundamentally different economy than it has been in previous cycles. I think the N on monetary tightening in the US is very small. Like the sample size is like 4 or 5 episodes of this over the past however many decades. So you have to think, like, we used to be much more sensitive to goods. Consumption and production were like much more manufacturing and construction heavy. So you had much more sensitivity to higher interest rates. We're really services oriented now. You know what I mean? It's like a 2-to-1 consumption of services to goods. So most consumers are buying services. And if you bought goods, you did it at when rates were 0% 3 years ago or 4 years ago, whatever. And for corporations, like, what am I investing in? I'm more so investing in like software, R&D, high tech areas rather than like large factories. SaaS is a rental. So, you know, software as a service is like a rental thing. You don't need a huge upfront cost. You have to like borrow to go get access to it. So it's much easier and cheaper to start a company these days. The cloud is, I mean, it sounds stupid to say the internet and the cloud are revolutionary, but like in terms of needing financing to do large CapEx or to get a company running, it's just not as big of a need. So we're not as sensitive to monetary policy anymore. I think that makes sense. I think it also makes sense when the deficit is 6 to 7% of GDP. It's obviously a whole range of factors, but the economy's changed a lot. It's the Fed's tools are not, they don't have the same effectiveness as maybe they did in prior cycles.
I want to ask you about the internals of the Fed's balance sheet. You mentioned 3 trillion MBS. What is the Fed doing on mortgages? Is it eventually going to sell them? How is it going to impact the housing market? And do you see any trouble in the real estate, in the residential real estate market in the Sun Belt? That's something that we've been covering. Is that a worry to you on the economy front?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if it's 2 or 3 trillion or whatever it is at this point, but regardless, it's too many, is the headline. I don't think they'll actually sell them. There doesn't seem to be, I think balance sheet policy is quite cautious at the Fed. If anything, they're going to stop running down their balance sheet sooner rather than later, based on pressures in the short-term funding markets. So it's kind of something that already happened, right? They're not going to sell MBS. They already bought it all. And that has decreased the affordability of housing by propping up prices when rates are up. Like a bond should structurally, the price should fall when rates go up, but mortgages haven't in part because of the Fed, but also structural issues like a lack of supply, et cetera. MBS haven't been running off like at all. There is a cap for how, I think, $30 billion a month. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I think that's it. But that cap hasn't been hit in any single month since quantitative tightening, you know, the Fed's balance sheet rundown program started, because no one's prepaying their mortgages. There's no refinancing going on. Everyone has a 3, 3.5, 4% mortgage. Rates are at 7%, so I'm not going to refi. Therefore, the duration has extended drastically. So balance sheet rundown has been extremely slow. Bank reserves have basically stagnated at like 3 trillion or wherever they're at. And, or I think 2.5, something like that. But yeah, QT has been slow, neutered to some degree. Like you're supposed to kind of take down reserves and, you know, increase duration risk in the market. The Treasury is issuing a lot more bills than it used to. It's just not a, you know, QE was used as like a real bazooka. They did a ton with it, but QT is like some sort of normalization. QT is the opposite of QE. Like it's supposed to have a legitimate impact, but I think the Fed, and going back to 2019, the Fed is nervous. They don't want to upset the short-term funding markets because like one little crack in the repo market can domino and cascade and become a much bigger problem for the financial system, which is the kind of thing that creates a credit crunch, right? Like that's what happened with Lehman. Like LTCM is another example. They're kind of separate issues, but like they all harken back to why the Fed is very worried about this area of the financial sector. So should they sell MBS? Like in terms of macroeconomic policy? Yeah, probably. Will they ever? For financial stability reasons, I don't think there's any chance they do.
Okay, so let's talk about cracks in short-term funding. We've seen some calendar stuff around SOFR. Is that what you're watching? What is your call on the end of QT? What are the cracks at the Fed? is paying attention to and paying attention to. And Eric, just be honest, because you were there. How closely are they watching what happens to SOFR on month end versus what we might think that, oh, they're not watching it that closely because they didn't mention it at the last meeting?
Yeah. No, I mean, they're hyper laser focused on this on a daily basis. They're so aware it's hard to, I'm understating it, like how aware they are. I think it's also helped by the fact that Lori Logan, who was the SOMA portfolio manager, so basically ran the Fed's portfolio while I was there, is now the Dallas Fed president. That's a huge help. So you have John Williams, who's attentive to this every day as a New York Fed president. It's not his wheelhouse, but he's really attentive to it because he's there. Lori Logan, who's attentive to this, and then the current SOMA and deputy SOMA managers are very good. Roberto Perli is fantastic and actually recently gave a speech and a presentation on what they're watching, like when should QT end, when are reserves too low. So yeah, there's been some pressures. By and large, I think most indicators say QT can keep going at least for another year. And I think there's appetite for that at the Fed. They know the balance sheet is too big. They'd rather let it run down. In terms of repo pressures at quarter ends or year ends, they're generally fine within the range you'd be okay with. I think what the Fed is starting to notice is that some market participants are paying up or like getting funding at higher levels than the median. That's something that might worry them. But in general, there's a ton of repo demand right now because there's a ton of demand for treasury futures. Basically, if you're an asset manager, a pension, you're real money, right? You're not leveraged. You want to get leverage because you don't want to use your balance sheet. So I'm CalPERS or whoever. I'm a large pension. I want to buy short-term investment grade corporate credit because it yields 6% and not 4% like treasuries do in an inverted curve. But that's like a 3-year duration. So I want to match ag, which is like a 6-year duration-ish. So I'll buy treasury futures, which are much lighter on my balance sheet. I'll basically push down swap spreads, which is another issue. And then hedge funds will provide that financing. They'll sell me that future and they'll go buy the actual treasury and they'll finance that through repo. So repo demand is absolutely off the charts, mostly due to this dynamic. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's a supply issue, right? The treasury issues too many treasuries and, you know, a lot are hitting the market, but I think the Fed has the tools to deal with any disruptions. The standing repo facility is legit. Like, it can absorb pressures. And I think the Fed is well equipped to deal with anything that hits them. So I don't know. I think QT probably goes for another year. They'll be quicker to end it than let it run, though.
Standing repo facility, for sure, something that exists today that didn't in 2019. So mm-hmm. Another defense mechanism that the Fed has. Eric, I could probably ask you 100 questions about your experiences trading repo at the Fed. We'll have to say that for another time. I want to ask you about private credit, though, because that's a topic that we don't get a lot of expertise on. We have a hunch that there's a lot hidden in there. And my experience tells me that if you're looking for the next, where did it come from, that it might be in private credit. Talk to us about what are the risks to private credit absorbing a lot of this debt that used to trade and now it doesn't? And what are there any signals that you watch, any metrics to see what the performance is there?
Yeah, it's funny because the biggest risk isn't necessarily a risk on its own. It's just the opacity of the market. It's so opaque. It's hard to see into. That obviously makes regulators very nervous. I'm not one to typically side with people who talk their book, but I know Mark Rowan at Apollo and some others in this universe have said, like, you know, every dollar that's in private credit and being lent out there, it makes the banking system $1 safer, right? Like the more loans that private investors can go make, the less that banks, which are almost a public utility, you know what I mean? Like, especially post great financial crisis, they're highly regulated, you know, they have very sensitive liabilities. I think it's probably a good thing that private credit is the one making those loans. The investors can usually ride out volatility. you know, it basically pensions and endowments and whoever is allocating funds to these guys. But it's like private equity, right? Like real estate prices got crushed. Stock prices in 2022 got crushed. Like, did private equity do as well as people said it did? No, of course not. But the end investors are like pensions with infinite time horizons who can kind of weather that. They're not like bank depositors, you know what I mean? Who can't weather that, who like need their funds. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I think there's plenty of shit in the private credit ecosystem. Loans made to poor companies, or like if you lent at, let's say, the SOFR rate plus 500 during COVID, 6% was fine as a growing middle market company. But you're now servicing 11 or 12% debt. They're doing payment in kind loans, which are basically just like borrow more to pay us. You know what I mean? It's more for the lender than the borrower. So I think there's a lot of companies that are struggling, but maybe these are shitty companies like that should be struggling. So it's not higher rates fault. It's just, you know, but there's a lot of money going to private credit. So you get spread compression. Like, you know, I think these companies should be fine, or there's plenty of terms, I guess. Like, you can get more bespoke lending terms, right? You're not dealing with big bank syndicates that are going to pull funding or have really tight covenants on you. Even if you get tighter covenants, like, the lenders are kind of trying to help you along, right? They don't want you to go bankrupt. So I'm cool with private credit. Like, is it going to be a huge source of, in terms of like me, an investor in private credit, will it be a huge source of returns going forward? I'm not sure it'll be as good as it has been the past couple years as a lot of money enters the space. But yeah, I'm okay with it. Like, you know, the loans are going to get made either way. I'd kind of rather them be there than at a bank.
Understood. Can you talk to us about bond volatility? So you mentioned that in an environment in which the economy can generally stomach 5% policy rates, growth is robust, inflation is sticky where it is, you're going to have an environment in which treasury yields are not coming materially lower, therefore somewhat elevated volatility. We've been studying the elevated bond volatility impact on equity returns and the correlation there. So talk to us about what it means for stocks if bonds go through a volatile year next year. Is there a direct correlation for you, a direct connection, or is it more second, third degree? And how do you think about bond vol and the move index and its impact on broader returns and risk?
Yeah, so I mean, historically, like the 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, which most people have a riskier allocation today, but plenty of retirees don't. A lot of target date funds get to that allocation mix. Historically, it does very bad when bond volatility is elevated. Again, like, there's a reason bond vol is elevated historically, right? Like, if you don't look at a time series chart, you're probably missing out on like a hiking cycle. Like, inflation was bad because there was stagflation or something like that. But historically, it's not good. And what you see when there's higher inflation and higher bond vol is the stock bond correlation tends to be positive. Like, it hasn't been for the past few months, or it's flipped back and forth. But for the past couple years, the stock bond correlation has been positive. Historically, 60-40 depends on the opposite, right? They should be inversely correlated. So when my stocks fall, my bonds are there to kind of offset some of the losses. My bond prices rise, yields fall. If you have an environment where we're higher for longer, right? Like, let's say the Fed cuts to 4% and we stay there, or 3.5%, whatever. That's higher than we've been used to for the past 15, 20 years. If we're there and we're having volatile inflation expectations, treasury supply becomes stronger in certain periods and impacts yields, as it did just over a year ago, last fall, when the 10-year yield rose to 5%, you're going to have bond yields rising, not just because of economic strength, but because of term premium, inflation expectations. And those are things that weigh on stocks. Like, when are multiples going to compress because yields are higher? When yields start rising for the wrong reasons, I think. That's why 4.3, 4.4% stocks are still at records, mostly because it's been stronger growth driving them higher. But if you get bonds spiking to 5.25% every so often because inflation's bad, or the treasury is just flooding the market with more debt, and pushing down prices, then I think you get stocks falling. And you'll have stocks falling, bonds falling, and those are like legitimate portfolio losses that, frankly, a lot of investors can't stomach, won't stomach, will be very upset about. It's just the environment where, like, what? How do you hedge, right? Like, and sophisticated investors will have other means. I think gold in that scenario where fiscal sustainability is an issue, like, gold is great. That's why gold has been largely going to new records outside of the past couple of days. But it just kind of upsets traditional portfolio theory. And it's why I said earlier on this podcast, like, I think bonds are a good income tool. You can, for pretty high rated credit, like high grade investment grade or highly rated investment grade debt, you can get like 6.5%. Those are pretty good coupons to clip. But I don't think like long-term investors are going to get the same value from fixed income as a legitimate hedge to their stock portfolios that they used to. And I think it's a big risk. It's a big paradigm shift for the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I don't know, but I think it's definitely a new norm.
It is a big paradigm shift, because if you've been a practitioner in the bond market in the previous decade, then you do have to rewire your approach to these markets and these cross asset correlations. So it's something that we are currently in the process of, and you know, we have to look at empirical correlations. And you know, yeah, we've seen, you know, the Trump trade had a little bit of that reversal in the correlation, and we saw stocks rising and bonds falling at the same time. But Eric is saying that might have just been a brief period of decoupling, that we might be returning to this environment of higher bond volatility causing some trouble for equity returns potentially at the margin. So do you have any more specific calls there for 2025? I know you've given us your rates outlook, but outlook on stocks going forward?
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty bullish on stocks. We have been among the biggest bulls on the street and recently raised our targets after Trump was elected. Not drastically, you know, we went from 5,800 by year end to a high end of 6,100, I want to say. I'd have to double check. But broadly, I think we think like 18 to 22 times earnings is a good PE. And we're really bullish on profit margins continuing to expand. Typically, you think of profit margins as cyclical. We've seen them trending higher, kind of like acyclically. They're just kind of grinding higher. We think that has more room to run, and we could get to like 15% margins by the end of 2026.
Is that technology and productivity, Eric? Is that something secular? Is there something great, larger going on in the global economy that maybe is not being captured by historical study?
Yeah, I think the first thing is a little less sexy. It's just that tech companies are becoming bigger parts of the index. So Meta, Microsoft, NVIDIA, like these companies have really good margins. So as they grow in terms of market cap, the overall margins get better. But like, you know, by and large, that means the economy, like corporate margins are getting better. But no, I think to your point, we're very bullish on productivity growth through the rest of the decade, if not further. Because if you look at high tech investment, software, R&D, information processing, which is like data centers, semiconductor fobs, like the investment in these sectors is growing exponentially, depending on how you're looking at it in nominal terms. In real terms, like it's going much higher. And I think we're already, you know, we're bullish on productivity growth going forward, but we're already seeing it. Like productivity growth, you can smooth it out over the past 20 quarters or 4 or 5 years. It has been going higher for the first time in a long time. The post great financial crisis world had really low productivity. I think in part due to like zero interest rate policy, there was no incentive for zombie companies to get more productive. There was funding everywhere. We had looser labor markets, but now we have very tight labor markets. I think we're at full employment or as close as we're ever going to get, and a ton of investment in automation, robotics, AI. There's still a shortage of workers, I think. Particularly skilled workers. We had a lot of immigration that was very helpful, but I mean, broadly, unemployment is due to rising labor supply. There's no layoffs, and plenty of companies, if you look at the small business survey, like half of the companies are like, we cannot find qualified applicants for our jobs. Wage gains are incredibly strong. We're seeing worker strikes and like large negotiated contracts because the labor market's still tight. That fuels productivity. You have a tighter labor market, you just get more productive workers. So yeah, I mean, we're it's not all AI, you know, it's just broader tech adoption, but we're really bullish on the outlook for that. And after the election, we got more bullish, assuming that deregulation and increased domestic investment kind of aids that story along.
Eric, this is maybe a random question, but did you pay attention to the Chevron Supreme Court case? And yeah, did that affect, because you mentioned regulation just now, so I wanted to bring that up because it's something that's been on our mind.
Yeah, Chevron deference, I don't know. I think it depends on how these agencies are run for the next 4 years. And I know it's a longer term thing, but at first a lot of people were upset about it because like agencies have the specialized knowledge to deal with a lot of these things, and courts, while impartial or supposed to be impartial, have less expertise on a lot of these areas. It's funny because the same people who said it was a big issue are like, today, now some of them are saying, I'm really happy because I don't want, you know, Trump's nominee to have much say. I'd rather have the court system deal with it. So I think it matters on a case-by-case issue. And it also depends on the makeup of the courts. Like, if you broadly get federal courts that are more Republican nominee dominated, you'll get, you know, rulings that favor less regulation. But no, that was not part of the overall thesis. I think it's just like, obviously this new administration is less like less regulatory happily, you know, going around slapping regulations on things.
Sure. So the call is definitely more based on the election results than anything that happened in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, we were calling this the roaring 2020s, saying that productivity growth is the big driver for a couple years. You know what I mean? Like, this has been the big driver regardless. I think we just got an extra oomph from the new administration.
Absolutely. Okay. So let me ask you about the dollar. Now, the dollar has had an incredible run. It's gone tick by tick with the 10-year yield, of course. So talk to us about the knock-on effects of a stronger dollar. Is that going to bring a tight financial condition that affects EM or something else that then filters back in to your framework? How are you thinking about the stronger dollar? And are there any particular currency pairs that you're watching?
Yeah, I mean, I think the dollar is strong. I don't think it's too strong, right? Like, it's at an okay value, especially I think market expectations are just based on the prevailing strength in the US economy. The market's still kind of hesitant that the Fed will cut all that much, especially relative to foreign domestic central banks. Like, Europe looks like shit, frankly. The ECB should be cutting, and probably the BOE as well. You're getting tighter monetary policy probably in some emerging markets, like Brazil is having inflation come back. Mexico, I think, is starting to see that, even though they went through their whole cycle earlier. I think dollar strength is good right now. It's helping tame inflation. Imports have been deflating, which is in part because China is just flooding the market with goods. But I think the strong dollar has been helping in that sense. I think emerging markets look good. I think it's really foreign, like advanced foreign economies that are struggling. You know, the dollar fell in large part because the yen was rapidly strengthening. Everyone kind of figured that out. That wasn't like the Bank of Japan didn't randomly wake up one morning, like the most dovish people on the planet didn't decide to get hawkish all of a sudden. So the market just had to shake that off. I think strong dollar's fine. I think the Trump presidency is strong dollar, at least in the short to intermediate term. He wants a weaker dollar to increase the competitiveness of you know, US exporters. I think that's gonna take a little time, but all else equal, I think strong dollar makes sense on economic fundamentals and rate projections. And I don't know, there's two wars going on and the Fed funds rate is high and the path of policy is much steeper or like, you know, less cuts than it was a couple months ago. Like, why shouldn't the dollar be strong? Gold is also very strong, which I think points to there's a variety of drivers here. But yeah, is it an issue? I don't think so. Like, okay, the dollar probably should be strong in this environment.
So answer this for us, because this is something that my team and I have been discussing. I agree with you. Trump wants a weaker dollar. It's something Vance has talked about. They want a weaker dollar.
Yeah.
And I think that they're going to abuse they're in the mood to abuse this idea that the dollar is the reserve currency of the world and we should just be using that to our advantage. I think that that's their approach. But my question to you is, if rates and the dollar are so highly intertwined, how does Trump get a weaker dollar without trying to pressure the Fed to cut rates? Can you just walk us through some of the game theory in terms of an independent Fed versus not, a politicized Fed versus not? It might not be something that you're covering a lot, Eric, but we are curious, you know, what the game theory is between the Fed and the Treasury here, and what Trump might want the Fed to do versus what they'll actually do for him with, you know, their independent mandate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it ends up becoming more of a multilateral or whatever lateral, but it becomes like a negotiation thing with other countries, which is not unprecedented. You know, we had the Luv Accord, we had the Pazza Accord before it, which is basically coordination among global central banks and foreign leaders to either, you know, buy their own currency and sell dollars, because all these countries, basically other than us, have reserve assets, or do the opposite. Alternatively, the US could build their own foreign reserves, right? I think any Fed coordination would be kind of more coordination with the Treasury, and it would have to deal with more like twisting the yield curve and affecting where they're either buying treasuries or investing maturing treasuries and maturing MBS. Someone I used to speak to when I was at the Journal a lot, Steve Moran, who was in the first Trump administration, just wrote a very good paper, essay, I suppose, a very long-winded kind of breakdown of what policy might look like under the second Trump administration, which is very good. I encourage you to read it. Basically detailing like the different ways that this might come about. People have floated the idea of a Mar-a-Lago Accord, which would basically be this multilateral currency intervention. So there's ways to go about it that don't dent Fed independence. I don't think if the Treasury Secretary is who it's likely to be based on betting markets, which I'm going to just cite from now on after the election result as you know, the most likely, the best indicator of election outcomes. If betting markets are right, you know, I think the next Treasury Secretary is very sensitive to this stuff. And this is an administration that cares a lot about financial market stability and asset prices going up, not down. So I think they would try and do it in a way that doesn't upset the market. Again, there's like so many more question marks than there are like concrete plans. I'm very hopeful and optimistic that they won't intervene with Fed independence, but obviously any overtures at that would be extremely detrimental to the market. So yeah.
Absolutely. We're gonna get Marin on. We've reached out and I believe we already have him on the calendar.
Awesome.
So
yeah, he's great.
Yeah, we're really trying to study this stuff and understand, you know, that the fiscal, first of all, the fiscal by itself is going to have, it's going to move the needle. And then what the impact that the fiscal is doing to the FOMC boardroom meetings is material. And he wrote about the impact over the last couple of years, and especially, so let's get right to the yield curve, the twist that you mentioned. You talked about bills. So give us your outlook, QRA going forward the next few quarters. What are we going to see? Are we going to see a huge influx of bills? Are we going to see debt issuance termed out? Are we going to see the Fed be maneuvered into absorbing one part of the curve versus the other? What's your outlook here?
Yeah, so I'm going to share a couple charts here. So this is the Treasury's issuance across the curve. So in green, you have bills. In red, you have notes, which is everything between 2 and 10 years. And then blue is longer-term debt, so like 20s, 30s. You can see the massive spike in bills, right? This was in part to refill the Treasury's account at the Fed. And then, you know, largely because I think there just wasn't enough appetite at the long end of the curve. We saw that when the 10-year yield hit 5%, the Treasury decided we're just going to issue a lot of bills. And, you know, if there's no demand at the long end, we're not going to upset it. And this is the amount of Treasury bills as a percentage of all debt. The range I'm citing, these kind of like dotted lines or whatever, is 20 to 15%. It's like the generally accepted range, the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, which is technically the private market, you know, advises the Treasury, but it's very much involved in the quarterly borrowing announcement and the Treasury's process. It's been higher than the range. Like, do we need all these bills right now when the economy is incredibly strong? We're not in a crisis and we're not like funding any gaps. Like, we're not trying to refill the TGA. No, I don't think so. I think a lot of the potential picks in the new administration are very sensitive to this idea. But if you issue more bills, the whole idea of quantitative tightening is to increase duration risk in the market. Well, if the Treasury actively decides, nope, we're going to issue short-term bills instead of duration, they're just kind of neutering that impact. They're not actually giving the market the duration to raise or to tighten financial conditions out in the market. So is it crazy that core services inflation is at 4.5%? No, I don't really think so, because we never really tightened financial conditions as much as we thought. So I don't know, this QRA was fine. Like, it was what it was, status quo. I think the issue is they're just going to keep getting bigger and bigger, and we're more likely to get borrowing estimates that surprise the market like it did last year. We can talk about the curve if I can figure out how to scroll. So here is break-even inflation. So 10-year break-evens, nominal 10-year treasury minus tips is in blue. And then the five-year forward swap, which is basically what does the market think inflation will be in the period 5 years to 10 years in the future, like 5 to 10. Both have risen substantially since these lows around, this is right when the Fed cut. And the Fed or Chair Powell said during his press conference, like, you know, I'm not too worried about yields rising. It's mostly due to stronger growth and it could be transitory, is basically what he said. I agree it has to do with stronger growth, but I think the Fed should be sensitive to the idea that inflation expectations are now much higher and arguably historically high. So the yield curve is still very flat around 10 basis points. I think the 10-year is around fair value based on economic growth and inflation expectations, but like, you very easily could get a steepening if the Fed keeps cutting and the bond vigilantes basically keep saying that's too much, it's too soon, and they jack up the long end of the yield curve, which would just mean higher mortgage rates, higher, like tighter financing conditions. It like literally would do the opposite of what the Fed is doing. So it's like, you know, the bond vigilantes fighting the Fed as opposed to the reverse.
So just summarize for me. Do you think that the Treasury Department in 2025 will try to keep that bill percentage high to prevent the term premium coming back into the market a la, you know, what we had 2023? Is that your base case? No.
I think they'd endeavor to lower it and actually term out the debt and start issuing longer term bonds. I think this is a tool. Like, increasing bill issuance, like, you can see it was a tool there. Like, it wasn't a tool during the great financial crisis. It's just like what happens during a crisis. It obviously happened to a substantial degree during COVID, but the question is like, why did it happen in 2023 and 2024 when like the market was going up and nothing was happening economically that was worrying? I think it's a tool going forward. And I don't think 22% is like crazy. As you can see, it has historical precedent, but the question is like, why are we doing it when there's no need to? And we probably should take it to the low. It's like, it's just like quantitative easing. You want to like leave yourself more firepower when there's a crisis. That's why you want the balance sheet to be smaller when there's not a crisis. Like, you need more more ammo or more room. So yeah, I think the next administration would try to lower this. And then, you know, it's a battle-tested tool. Like, it worked last year. The cost is, you know, a higher cost to taxpayers because they're funding in bills. And then a lot of refinancing risk, because if the Treasury is just, like, refinancing a bigger and bigger and bigger portion of their debt every 6 to 12 months, then, like, you know, you get more volatile. You get a more volatile Treasury market, and they're more, therefore, more volatile financial markets broadly. But I don't know. It's an important story, but it plays out over, you know, intermediate to long-term horizons until it doesn't, and it becomes very acute, and then it becomes worrying. So it's something to watch for sure. But, you know, a lot of question marks still.
Eric Wallerstein, Yardeni Research, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of this market. Incredible insights, great charts, and a really detailed outlook of what to expect over the coming months with regard to Treasury yields, the yield curve, the new administration's regulatory policies, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us again.
Nick, thanks a bunch. This was great. And for anyone out there who wants to get our analysis, we do have a product for like retail and financial advisors called Yardeni Quick Takes, where we'll send out 4 or 5 charts each day and tie in some of the macroeconomic indicators to what's going on in the market and kind of our take. You can learn more at yardenikwicktakes.com. I think it's a really great resource, but yeah, thanks again, Nick. This was great.
Yeah, of course. And the great thing about the Yardeni School of Research is that there is a very fundamental fixed income focused approach to the research. And it meshes a lot with my background. That's why I use some of these tools in my classroom. So it's a great resource for people, and they should definitely go check it out. Eric, thanks again for joining us today. And we'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks, Nick.